he said, I'll then invade the neighboring countries. And he starts naming off the countries and what his plan is for each country until he ultimately has a 5 million man military. He said, I will be in charge of the largest private military in the world once I've taken all of Africa. Hey, this is Matt Cox, and we are continuing with the Frank Amadeo story. It's Insanity. Let me hold up the book. Look, It's Insanity. And I think we last left off. Frank was in Latvia, Riga. Riga, Latvia, actually, I think. So the city of Riga in Latvia. He had flown in there with a group of his guys, and he had been approached, someone from the CIA spoke with him. They did not want him to basically to invade Tajikistan. So it never happens. Whether it never happens because of what happened with his meeting with the CIA, I don't know. You'll have to figure that out. Frank doesn't. Well, Frank thinks he knows, but you never know. Based on everything that I looked at and everybody I spoke with, it could be many things. I think that may have been a factor. So during the day, they have at the NATO summit, they have meetings with the way the summit works is obviously they have some meetings where you have, like, you know, President Bush comes in and gives a talk, and there's multiple heads of state that come in and give talks on what's going on in their region, things they're concerned about, things they want to work on, you know, where these countries are going. So Bush does come in. He gives a speech. Frank's there. Frank is meeting with multiple. They have different activities. And one of the things Frank had explained to me was that there's tons of people from major industries that come there, right? They want to meet with the heads of state to talk about, you know, lumber rights, or, you know, mineral rights, or, you know, building a pipeline, or whatever the case may be. You know, hey, you know, maybe you're China and you're trying to convince, you know, some South American country to let you build a port. So you kind of go there and you court them and try and meet everybody and schmooze. One of the things they do is they have what's called, after these large meetings, they have breakout groups. And anybody who's been to a seminar or a convention understands what I'm talking about. You have these large auditoriums where almost everybody attends, and then you have breakout groups because not everybody's interested in the same thing. One of the things which I found fascinating, and I think this helps, I think this kind of helps people, will help people understand how Frank's mind works. He was at a breakout meeting or breakoff meeting. I think they call it breakout or break, what do they call it? Breakout group. It was a breakout group where they were talking about the problems that NATO has with some countries that aren't paying their dues. So there's a lot of countries that, for instance, you know, they expect NATO, they want to be a member of NATO, but they're not meeting the parameters that are set to be a member of NATO. So I'll give you an example. Take Ukraine. Ukraine, for example, one of the things that you have to do is you have to donate a portion of your, you know, gross national product, right? Or you have to contribute a certain amount of money to NATO. You have to contribute a certain amount of money to maintaining NATO troops, even though they're your troops. And also your military hardware has to be to NATO standards. So you can't be using Soviet era weaponry and tanks, AK-47s. You know, you have to use, like, I think it's a 5.62 rounds. You can't use the 7.62 rounds, right? You have to use the NATO rounds. You have to use the NATO. You have to use their stuff, because what they want, obviously, is that if you all go to war, that you'll be using the same armament. So it's easy to supply one another. It's easy to maintain those types of that type of equipment. So that's one of their parameters. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of these countries, like, they're behind on their dues. Right? They're not providing the amount of money that they need to provide. but they still expect, they're still expecting, like if they were invaded, they would immediately want NATO to come to their aid. Okay, but you know, you're behind, you know, $500 million in your dues. You know, you have to pay annual like dues, or I don't know if they're monthly. I don't know what they are. But anyway, so Frank's, they're having this discussion. And they have this discussion. Every country donates a certain amount of troops to maintain, you know, the NATO, whatever, presence or military. But many countries are behind. So Frank, they go to this group and they start talking about that and how to resolve these problems and what kind of, you know, like how do you get people to pay and what kind of things could be done to offset that payment? Could they provide more troops? Can they allow their country to be used as a military base? Like what types of things? And Frank came in and said, listen, in the 16th and 18th century, privately owned armed ships and privately owned military groups were given what's called letters of marque, which means that the King of England would say, look, you're running 8 ships. You've got 8 vessels here that have cannons on them. We're going to give you a letter of marque, and we're going to allow you to essentially be pirates, licensed pirates. You can go and you can attack ships to our enemies. So the French, the Italians, you know, the Spanish, they were all like it. Let's say they were all at war at different times with England. England, one of the things they would do is they would privatize their military by giving letters of marque to these ships, and those ships would end up attacking their enemies. And they had to give like 30% of the booty, I think that's what they called it too. 30% of whatever they got had to go, and it may have been 20% or 50%, I don't know. But they had to give like 30% of it over to England to maintain their letters of marque. And what Frank suggested is, listen, there's lots of private militaries out here. And if Spain is behind $500 million on their dues or $1 billion on their dues, but they have boats, you know, oil rigs that are going through bodies of water that are maintained by NATO or that are helped supported by NATO, why don't we just seize their, why don't you have these private military groups go in and seize their oil tankers? And then they can sell the oil tankers, and then you'll get NATO will get 30% or 50% or whatever the deal is. So that's the kind of thing that he talked about. And there were different things that he was saying could be seized. And keep in mind too, you're talking about seizing members' stuff, right? So you go in and you seize this oil and you seize this and you do this and you, so he had a very unique, and he had a whole plan, and it was laid out brilliantly, and he explains the whole thing. But keep in mind, every time Frank opens his mouth, these guys are like, wow, this is, I mean, it's insane. It sounds insane, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. Like, it is a solution to a problem that NATO itself has not created. These are NATO members that aren't paying their dues but expect protection. Let's grab some oil tankers. You guys are saying, oh, we don't have the money. Well, we'll grab some of your oil. We'll grab a few oil tankers that have $200 million worth of oil. That'll go a long way towards your back dues. After the first or second day, the summit, you know, these conferences last several days. The summit lasted several days, 4 or 5 days. So after the second or third day, here's where it goes wrong for Frank. He's attending an after party, let's say. I think, you know, they're basically having, you know, coffee and tea, and they're at some hotel someplace or someone's private residence. I'm not quite sure. But there's a significant amount of people that are involved in NATO there. Maybe they're associates. Maybe they're members of NATO. They're staff. But they're there. And everybody's sitting around talking and laughing and joking around. And someone says to Frank, Mr. Amadeo, I see what happened in the Congo. We were wondering, what are your plans for the Congo? And Frank says that his interest in the Congo, and by the way, I just saw it right here. It was one of the Riga, one of the luxury hotels in Riga, the Grand Palace Hotel. So they're there. They're having, you know, they're talking, and one of them says, "What is your plan for the Congo? What was your plan?" And he explains what his plan was, and they said, "Well, you know, is that?" They asked if it was off, you know, and he said, "No." He said, "I'm currently negotiations with the president. We're going to be placing a security force there." And he'd actually the agreement he was making with them was there's a certain tribe in the Congo that is kind of disenfranchised, right? Like they're not really let into the government. They're kind of on their own. They're extremely upset with the way things are, but there's a ton of them. They're also a problem. And the name of that tribe is the Mimbaju Mai. I sound like Donald Trump trying to say one of these names. Mimbaju Mai tribe. And what Frank says is he's going to go, the first thing he's going to do is once he gets into the Congo, he's going to go in and he's going to get 500,000 of these guys that are unemployable. Well, they're just unemployed. You know, if you're the Congo government, the Republic of the Congo won't hire them because they're such troublemakers and they're not happy with the status quo. So they end up being kind of, you know, then they're unemployed. So he's going to go in, employ them, train them as soldiers and make them private military. And his plan was, he said, "I'm going to build a 500,000 man strong army out of this tribe." Now, once that's done, he said, "I'll then invade the neighboring countries." And he starts naming off the countries and what his plan is for each country until he ultimately has a 5 million man military. He said, "I will be in charge of the largest private military in the world once I've taken all of Africa." And he said, "Once I've got all of Africa, it will be such a large group of soldiers or private military that I'll be able to, it'll be large enough to police the entire planet," he said, "and then we won't need NATO." Now he's in the middle of a manic moment and he starts spouting off these things and laughing and joking. But he just said he's planning on building the largest private military in history and eliminating NATO. At that level, that is a horrendous thing to say, especially from a man who was a plot to take over the Congo, which it was just foiled. So he says this, he doesn't really realize what he said or the impact. Spends the rest of the night there talking. An hour or two later, he leaves, spends a couple more days at the conference, gets into his plane. He's flying over the Atlantic. Halfway over the Atlantic, he gets a phone call from his lobbyist. Remember, I had said in one of the earlier videos, he had hired a lobbyist that had been connected to Bill Clinton. Right? She'd been like a staff member with Bill Clinton, and she had left and started a lobbying firm. And he'd hired her. So he gets a phone call from her, and she says, "Did you just tell members of NATO that you're planning on building a massive private military and eliminating NATO?" And he says, "Well, I may have said something along those lines." Like, it starts to dawn on him. And she says, "I'm getting multiple calls from different people in the government asking what this is about." She's like, "Frank." And he said, "Well, I was just saying that, you know, eventually, you know, that might be something that happened." He starts trying to backpedal. And she says, "Frank, you were just in the Congo. Your people were just in the Congo. And there was what everybody believes is a military coup was just foiled. Like, and now you're talking about building a massive army and taking over NATO. Like, this isn't something that these people are taking lightly." Anyway, she says she's going to do damage control. They land the plane a few hours later. He gets off. And within a few days, target letters start appearing. Let me explain what target letters are. When the FBI is investigating companies, the first thing they do, when they're investigating massive companies for fraud, the first thing that they do is they send out target letters to everybody that may or may not be a member of, or I'm sorry, they send out target letters to anyone that they believe may be involved in fraud, or is at the very least under investigation for fraud, right? So all of the, you know, all the board members and different various people that are a part of Frank's company get these letters saying, hey, it's from the FBI, it's a target letter. They're investigating me. And what typically happens is a lot of those people will, they do this, you know, they say they do it to notify people, to let them know, you know, not to destroy anything, that we will be contacting them, that, you know, but really what they're doing is really kind of a phishing excursion where they're trying to see if any of those people will contact them to say, hey, listen, I know what's going on, and then cooperate. Well, all these guys start getting the letters. A few people contact the FBI. They may or may not have you know, tried to help fill them in. But overall, the bulk of the people that were involved in Frank's company genuinely didn't think they were doing anything wrong. Now, once the FBI goes in, they start subpoenaing records. They start getting just gobs of records. They start reading through everything, and they end up getting a few people that are willing to talk. And these people explain about that Frank is currently, several of his companies are behind on their payroll taxes, but that they're making the payments. They're in negotiations with the IRS. They're actually in This is what's interesting about this. Part of the negotiation process was that Frank was saying he was going to bring the company public, and to pay part of the back debt that he owed the IRS, let's say, so the back payments. So let's say he owes the IRS whatever. I think it ended up being like $200 million, but at this point, it's probably $160, $180. I think he got hit for $180 million. So let's say $180 million. And what he ends up saying to them is, if you'll take stock in the company when we go public, you'll be made whole. Now, the problem with that is they were having a hard time getting anybody to sign off on that deal because technically the government isn't allowed to own stock in a private company or accept stock in lieu of a payment. Here's what's funny about that. A few years later, when the economy collapses, the government ended up taking stock in all of the banks that it had bailed out. So the same proposal that Frank was proposing, they were having a trouble getting anybody that would agree to do it. 2 years later, they all jump on board. They have no problem at all. Sure, we'll do that. So, you know, so in Frank's defense, you know, he's got a viable out for what he's behind on. Anyway, the government uses that to say, what you're doing is, this is money that you have that you're using for other things. Listen, and Frank will tell you that he didn't use that money for anything other than, his current businesses, that money was put aside, that they were just behind. But the truth is, a lot of that money was going to places it shouldn't have been going to. And Frank has never said this to me, but you know, after looking at the documents and listening to what the U.S. attorney said and reading the indictment and everything else, you know, it's pretty clear to me, assuming the government's not lying, that money was reallocated for other ventures. Now, Frank seems to think that that's acceptable. The government doesn't. And it's not up to me to, you know, to make that determination. Although if I had to, I would say it's fraud. But what they do is they use this to craft an indictment and indict Frank. They indict Frank. Frank goes out and hires an attorney, gives that attorney $1 million. He says, listen, here's $1 million. You're a criminal defense attorney. Here's $1 million to represent me. So if we have to go to trial, if we have to do whatever, here's $1 million. Guy says, I got it. I got you. Well, the indictments come down and they come in and Frank has to be, he's arrested. He's arrested and he's arrested. And initially what happens is they end up saying to the judge, Your Honor, our problem is that we believe, and keep in mind that Frank's private psychiatrist or psychologist, which one can give you medicine? Whatever, the one that can give you medicine, he comes in and he explains to the judge that, look, Frank is under the delusion that he believes that he is preordained to be emperor of the world. And I say it like that because that's how Frank says it. So he believes that he's ultimately going to, you know, be the world leader of the, what Frank calls the Terran Empire. And Terran means like Earth, I think. So I don't know. It's, what's so funny about it is that that's actually taken from Star Trek. There's actually like Khan, I think Khan in the Star Trek, it wants to rule over the Terran Empire or something like that. So I'm sure somebody will tell me in the comment section, bro. It was hilarious. Like it's from a Star Trek episode. So he's going to rule over the Terran Empire as, you know, which is the Earth, as the emperor. He explains this to the judge and says it's been a reoccurring fantasy and delusion of Frank since he was in his teens, and that he would like to have him evaluated because their argument to the charges are this. Yes, this is what Frank did, but he was in contact with the IRS. He had numerous meetings with the IRS. The IRS had never told him not to do these things. The IRS was aware of how much money the company was behind. They were working with him. They were currently in negotiations. And even if some of those funds were diverted or things were, or it wasn't, everything wasn't exactly on the up and up, even if that's the case, Frank was unaware of it as a result of his mental illness. So I believe it's the government that says they want to have Frank evaluated for schizophrenia or to determine what kind of mental illness. Now, Frank always kind of says, you know, the way he explains, he is a rapid cycling bipolar with features of schizophrenia. So in his manic moments, he will say things that are based on delusion and, you know, like schizophrenics do. You know, he sees and hears things that are not, and believes things that are not based, well, they are based in reality, but are not possible, that are not really happening. For instance, God talking to him. Or hey, maybe God is talking to him. Who am I? Here's the cool thing about that. They end up taking Frank and they transport him to Harvard Medical School's, or is it Harvard? I think it's on Harvard Medical School on the campus, but it's, anyways, somehow or another, it's Harvard Medical, for a mental evaluation to a mental hospital that's run by Harvard. I think it's called McLean, and it has something to do with Harvard. Anyway, point is, Frank goes there for like a week. They interview him, and they dope him up. They put him on a ton of medication. They bring him back after a week, and they say he has a mental illness. That he's a rapid cycling bipolar with features of schizophrenia. However, they've put him on enough medication to get his levels into a moderate area, and he's now able to understand the difference between right and wrong, and they can move forward on the prosecution. So you can imagine how that didn't work in his favor. Like, we're just going to dope him up. And now we're going to say, okay, we've stabilized his rapid cycling, you know, issues, his bipolar issues. We've stabilized him, and now you can prosecute him. Okay, but the point is that when I wasn't on the medication, I made those decisions. So that doesn't make, so that's no good at all. He should be, he shouldn't, he was never in his right mind when he made some of these decisions. Well, what happens is the prosecution comes to Frank, goes to Frank's lawyer. So the U.S. attorney goes to Frank's lawyer and says, listen, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take him to trial. But the first thing we're going to do is we're going to go to the judge and we're going to say we want to seize all the bank accounts and we want to do what's called claw back. We want to claw back any money that he's spent that we can get a hold of. And he paid you $1 million. So we're going to take your $1 million retainer because it's fraudulent money. We're going to take him to trial. We're going to go after the $1 million first to seize it. And you'll be on the hook for doing a what should be a $1 million trial for nothing. Now, I believe that there's an email that states this. Now, I want to say Frank showed me the email, or I have it in my records, that talks about the $1 million, his $1 million deposit or you know, whatever they call that. So after that meeting, this attorney, while Frank is completely doped up, Frank and his psychiatrist go to Frank and they convince Frank to take a plea. Now, he tells Frank, you know, what you did was illegal. He tries to explain it to him. Frank's so doped up, he didn't know what he's doing. And they said, look, Frank, you're looking at a few years at most. If you plead guilty, you're looking at a few years. So Frank goes in and they said, and part of the agreement is that the prosecution has allowed Frank to take the stand and fully explain his rise to, you know, power and what he had expected and what his delusions were and why he was, you know, why he was delusional and what he was thinking, basically. And keep in mind, these guys convinced Frank, and in Frank's mind, he's like, yeah, if I explain it, he'll understand that I didn't really mean to do anything wrong and I didn't realize that what I was doing was wrong. And even now, even at that point, Frank was so drugged up, he didn't even realize that what he was pleading to. But his high-priced lawyer and his, and the guy's name was Dr. Danziger. Anyway, the doctor is telling him to do it. The lawyer's telling him to do it. And he's so drugged up, he can't see straight. So he pleads guilty to, it was ridiculous, like one count of, you know, wire fraud against the United States government. Like it's a minor charge. And then they have a hearing. Well, at the hearing, Frank takes the stand. First of all, lots of people take the stand. Okay. So, but, and it was really, I want to mention this. While writing this in prison, I'm listening to Frank. I'm able to interview some people. I'm able to get affidavits. I'm able to read the transcripts. But listening to him, there were times when I would think, that's not true. That's insane. Like, for instance, you know, going into a meeting wearing a Darth Vader helmet. You didn't do that. But then you read the transcripts. And in the transcripts, they're talking to this woman. And she starts talking about, they're like, did you ever know that? Did you realize that he was, you know, mentally ill and this and that? And she's like, well, like she doesn't want to admit it. But she's like, yeah, there were signs. And she says, they go like, what? Like, he's like, well, one time he came in a Darth Vader helmet. And she explains that whole situation. She explains several different things that had happened to her. One of them I didn't even put in the book, but I thought it was hilarious. And that was that she had, according to Frank, she had stolen proprietary programs that they were using. And wouldn't return them. And Frank had called her up and threatened her and all these things. And a few days later, her house was burglarized and her computers were stolen. Now, Frank has the ability to have his security, his private guys in the private security fly to her. And she lives several states away, fly to that state, break into her house, steal the stuff, and leave and not get caught. So, but you know, I didn't put that in there because I have no proof of that. But But that's what she that's what Frank said she believed. That's what she's mentioned. I think she mentions it in the transcripts. It's insane. So yeah, it was Edie Curry. She was not happy with Frank. But several guys get on the stand. They all say basically the same thing. And what happens is Frank eventually takes the stand. He's up there all day. I think he might have been there for 2 days, but I'm going to say all day. He's up there all day. He explains that he's been hearing these voices since he was young. He tells the story over the course of 4, 5, 6 hours, however long it takes, tells the entire story. And to the judge, you have to understand, he sounds insane. Now, he's lucid, but he's doped up. It's funny too. I remember he had told me how he was on a ton of drugs, and he was literally at one point that, like, his lawyer had mentioned to him that he's drooling, drool was running down the side of his face, and, you know, it was horrible. But when I read the transcripts and Frank starts listing all the drugs that he was on to the judge, like, anybody that reads it can't believe that judge didn't say, listen, this guy's drugged out of his mind. We're not going through with this. Like, this is insane. You know, it's so benign, the things that happened. You know, nobody got killed. Nobody was hurt. Like, this is clearly, it ends up being, you know, even though there's a ton of money involved, it really ends up being like accounting errors and a misunderstanding. But that's not the way, ultimately, that's not the way the judge sees it. The judge ends up, listen, and by the way, Frank explains about the Terran Empire. He explains, it's insane reading these things. It's fucking pure insanity. And that's all I could think of the whole time I was writing this thing was, this is insanity. And that's why I ended up naming the book It's Insanity. The judge ends up, you know, what's so fucked up about the judge is he ends up saying, you know, after hearing everything, he ends up saying that, I don't think this is mental illness. I think it boils down to just greed. I mean, he's just like, he ends up just saying this completely. I wonder if I could even find it. I'm sure I can find it. It's ridiculous. So let me read this. I'm going to just read this. I just was flipping through the book just to give you an example that how insane that it had to be sitting in the courtroom listening to this. This is, and I forget, I don't even know who's saying this, but Sands is the, he's the attorney. It says, Frank Amadeo consistently with his brain disorder spent the money on world domination. He's going to be some sort of emperor, and there is a cooperative economy system under the sponsorship of Frank Amadeo, who has basically taken the place of the United Nations. Sands went on to describe his client as a megalomaniac with delusions of grandeur when not properly medicated. Amadeo was, in fact, so delusional, he believed that he could take money from the federal government and use it for other purposes to create the biggest corporation on earth. I don't even know what to say. So I've got excerpts. These are just excerpts because nobody wants to read the whole thing, right? Like, I'm not going to make you read all the transcripts. That's ridiculous. I just take some excerpts and put it together. But, you know, if I have to say, I think it was put together pretty well. Here's what the judge said. Now, it's a few paragraphs. There's no dispute that the defendant suffers from a mental disorder, admitted the judge. However, Antoon is the name of the judge, doubted that the illness contributed to his mental capacity. And this is after everybody has said it contributed. But the judge said, he's going to forget the doctors, forget the lawyers, forget the staff, forget his wife, everybody, forget all that. He then sentenced Amadeo to the custody of the Bureau of Prisons to be imprisoned for 22 years and 6 months. Because 22, rounding it off to 22, that wasn't enough. The 6 months, that's had to be done. Disregarding all of the evidence to the contrary, the judge closed out the sentence with, the offense was committed out of greed. Now, here's the problem with this. And my buddy Pete and I, we used to walk around and, you know, laugh about the whole story and the things that I was uncovering and the things I was reading. And I would come to Pete and be like, bro, you gotta read this and show it to Pete and show the memos and the affidavits and the everything. Here's the thing about Frank. And this is literally almost verbatim the conversation we had. Listen, here's why I think that Frank, it's truly delusion. He was not done out of greed. He did not take this money or use this money for other purposes out of greed. With the money that Frank diverted to his plans for world domination, Frank bought a house, a middle-class home. He lived in a middle-class home. He drove a Mercedes that was 5 or 10 years old. He spent almost no money on himself. He worked 80 hours a week. He had a staff. He was always available. He worked so much it drove his wife crazy. And he didn't go on any lavish vacations. He didn't do any of those things. And I remember Pete saying, if you gave me $180 million, I would be living in a penthouse with 10 strippers in their early 20s. I would be a maniac. I would be driving a Ferrari or a Lamborghini. I would be taking exotic vacations. It would be a free-for-all. Frank didn't do that. Frank was married. Frank was married with two kids. And these aren't even his children. These are his wife's children that he takes care of. Like I said, doesn't have a flashy car, doesn't live in an extravagant house. He's just living a upper middle class life. He's not spending this money on himself. It wasn't done out of greed. It was done out of delusion. He didn't know what he was doing. You know, he's diverting these funds, not realizing exactly what's happening. I mean, do I think that, of course, there's a part of him that knew maybe that this isn't right? Yeah, there's probably a part of him it's kind of a scam because I could pay this money over, but I'm using it to restructure the companies. And part of his restructuring is, let's try and take over the Congo. Let's try and do these other things. And let's try and get the companies into a position where we can go public and we can bring in even more money. And I'll use some of that money to pay off the IRS. And in his mind, all of that was reasonable. So he has diminished capacity. So even if you know, diminished capacity is like you understand that there's an issue, but you don't understand the real danger or really how bad it is. So you have diminished capacity. You don't quite understand that what you're doing is completely illegal or illegal to the extent that you're going to get a 22-year prison sentence. And that's really what I think. So here's the even more interesting part is that Frank is sent to federal prison. He goes to federal prison, and you know what they do in federal prison? They give him even more dope. They dope him up even more. They put him on all kinds of medication where he's basically a zombie, which is where I saw him when I first met Frank, and I would see him in the chow hall line, and he would just sit there. I mean, he's a zombie. You could barely talk to him, and he stays in that state for over a year. Now, here's the thing. In order for you to file what's called a 2255, which is a motion where you're saying my lawyer doesn't know what they're doing or didn't know what they're doing or didn't adequately represent me, they were ineffective. You have 1 year. You have 1 year to file that. They kept Frank so doped up, he didn't even realize that the year had passed. The other thing is, so when Frank comes back from McLean, the Harvard hospital, you know, it's so he's been declared incompetent is probably not the right word, but in the state of Florida, they declare him incompetent, and they give him a guardian. So they assign you a guardian that works for the state. Now, if you're declared incompetent, you're made a ward of the state. So you don't get to drive. You don't get to open a bank account. You don't get to sign a contract. You can't buy a house. You can't do anything. Now, they assign this. You can't write a check. The government is the one that pushed for him to get a guardian, right? His lawyer, everybody is on board with it. They give him this guardian. Once they've got him doped up, they bring him in because they don't want him to write any checks. They don't want him to be able to do anything without this guy's permission. They then have him plead guilty. So he pleads guilty. He signs a plea agreement without his guardian's consent, without his guardian's knowledge. His guardian didn't even know that the government had had him sign and his lawyer had had him sign a plea deal. Didn't even know it. So when Frank goes to prison, he first gets to prison. He calls his guardian to let him know where he is because the guardian's taking care of Frank's accounts and businesses and that sort of thing. He calls the guardian and the guardian's like, "Hey, Frank." The guardian thinks he's calling from the county jail or from the U.S. Marshals holdover. And he tells him, "I'm in Coleman. I'm in the Coleman low security prison." He goes, "Why?" He said, "This is where they sent me." Keep in mind, he's out of his mind. He's all drugged, filled with drugs. And they said, "This is where they sent me after I was sentenced." And he says, "When were you sentenced?" He goes, "They had me sign a plea agreement and they sentenced me to 22 years and 6 months." And his guardian is like, "What?" He's like, "How is that even possible? You're not even allowed to sign a plea. You can't sign anything without my permission." So they keep him drugged up. And a year later, when Frank finally sobers up and they start taking him off the drugs, he realizes, "I never even had the ability to plead guilty." So he files a 2255. And you know what the court says? "You're time barred. You had 1 year to file it. It's been a year and 2 months. Or a year and however many, it was just over the 1 year. You're time barred. We can't even look at your case. We can't consider this information because you had 1 year to put it in and you didn't." And as a result, Frank ended up getting stuck with a 22-year sentence. Because despite what you watch on Law and Order and on the TV shows that are out there, the law is extremely unfair to prisoners. Well, eventually, once they've got him locked up in jail and he's locked up with me, they take him off the meds and Frank starts teaching the legal research class and he starts training guys on how to do legal work. And he just becomes a little workaholic because, you know, he's manic most of the time. He maintains his manic state by drinking sodas. He drinks at least 2 or 3 cases, like 12 packs a day. It's insane how much soda he drinks. He's a really interesting guy. And I've already gone over, if you've watched the other videos, you'll see that he got 12 years knocked off my sentence. Just an amazing, amazing human being. You know, a deeply flawed human being, as most amazing human beings are, unfortunately. I mean, there's always some guy you think, "Wow, what a great guy. Like, this guy's perfect in every way. He's personable. He's funny. He's nice. He's extremely intelligent. He's helpful. He's brilliant," you know, and that works for 5 or 10 years. And then you find out that they've got somebody chained up in the basement and you realize, "Oh, wow, he did have some issues." So once I got out of prison, and I got out of prison just before Frank did, and I don't know if I went over this or not, I was talking to Frank and I said, I was emailing Frank, which I'm not supposed to do. But so we're emailing, each other back and forth, and I explained to him that I wanted to take the synopsis, and I wanted to turn the synopsis that I'd written, because it was hilarious too, by the way. I'm following Frank around, and when I eventually finished the synopsis, and it was like 20 pages or something. Did I tell you this? That Frank, I gave it to Frank to read, and I was very open about who he is and the things that happen and the whole thing. Like I don't hold back any punches. He read it and came back and loved it. He loved it. You know, it honestly, like in a prison setting, he's a pretty cool dude. Even the whole manic, wanting to take over the world, megalomaniac, you know, that whole thing in prison makes you a lot cooler than the drug dealer that had six guys working for him. I tell you that. You're a lot cooler than some guy working for the cartel or some guy who's running a Ponzi scheme and stole $50 million. Like, listen, this guy's taking over the world. This guy's a James Bond villain, you know? So he loved it. He loved it so much. He got them printed up. He started having people print up the synopsis over and over and over again and handing it out to people. Like, people would come and say, I wanted to talk to you about doing my legal work. He'd say, well, the first thing, if you want me to do your legal work, the first thing you need to do is read this. And he'd give them a copy of It's Insanity. And they'd read it. I mean, listen, it was, and honestly, it was great too, because people would read it and they'd come by me and they'd be like, Cox, you got any other stuff? Like, this is insane. This is fucking great. Do you have anything else I can read? And I was like, yeah, sure. I got some other stuff. So when I got out though, Frank was still locked up. And so I wanted to blow that synopsis up into a full blown book, right? Like not a big book. You know, I probably could have done a good 300 pages. The problem was, initially I asked Frank if he could put me in contact with some of the people that he had worked with so I could interview them, really kind of beef up, you know, what I already had. And he put me in contact with those people and I talked to some of them, but in the middle of arranging some of the interviews, Frank got wind that he was going to get himself released on the, I want to say it's the First Chance Act, where you can get yourself, where if you've done more than 50% of your sentence and you're over the age of 50 and there's all these little criterias, and Frank met all of them. So he was helping me arrange meetings and interviews with many of the people he had worked with. And I'd interviewed a couple of them, but suddenly he contacted everybody and told them that he didn't want them to talk to me and that he would be handling all media upon his release. And he got out, whatever, a month or so later, he actually was released. And so he didn't do 22 years. He did like 11. So he did like, let's say, and I could be off. It might be 9, it might be 12, but let's say 10 or 11 years he did. He was released to a halfway house in Orlando. He was then put on an ankle monitor. He then got out of the halfway house, went to work for like a law firm, I believe, and ended up consolidating a couple of different companies. And essentially, starting the whole process again. He started consulting for companies that were in distress. He started negotiating. I mean, he starts doing the whole thing over again. But here's why I think he called all these guys and told them he didn't want them to talk to me. Because initially when I wrote this, and Frank was thrilled to have me blow it up into a full book. What's cool in prison isn't cool on the street. Guys that have conversations in prison about things and talk to each other and have discussions and what they think is cool and funny are vastly different than when they get in the real world. Frank thought to himself, I feel he was about to get out. When I was writing the book, he had at least 10 more years. So me writing a book that brings attention to his situation, he was okay with, because he's locked up. But now suddenly he's getting out. And he didn't want me to tell the story of a borderline schizophrenic that believes God is telling him he's going to take over the world. And he's trying to take over countries, and he's doing all of these things. Now that makes him look crazy. What he want, the story he wanted told was the story of a guy that was bipolar, not schizophrenic, bipolar, and had made some bad decisions and ended up being taken advantage of by the government. His situation was taken advantage of by the government, and he ended up going to prison. He got an improper sentence, and he's really a brilliant person that was misunderstood, was framed practically, and he's now starting his life over again. He doesn't want to focus on the delusions. And so he put the kibosh on my interviews. Now, Frank, knowing me, you would have thought he would have realized that's probably, it's probably better to, it's better to work with me. You know, it's better to do a controlled blast than it is to bulldoze the building and not know what's happening, right? So he could have come to me and said, look, here's what I want. You know, let's negotiate how this story, what we're going to talk about in the story. We could have probably done that, maybe. But instead, he just tried to shut me down. And so what I did was I then started making phone calls and started contacting people that Frank wasn't in contact with anymore. And I interviewed those people. And then I went and I found all the affidavits that had been placed in the court. And I read those affidavits and I included them as interviews. I then read all the transcripts and I included those as interviews. I then found a former CIA agent who was Andrew Bustamante, which I'm sure some people know. He's huge. I interviewed him for the book. So I went and did a whole slew of interviews that were unrelated to Frank. And the thing is, that had Frank probably could have had those people that I was going to interview, he probably could have had them help tweak the story. But instead, I had to go around him and get a very accurate version of the story. Since Frank's gotten out, like I haven't spoken with him, I do know that he was rearrested. He was in the government rearrested, well, they violated his supervision, his release, right? So they release you and they violated his supervision and had him thrown back in jail for about 6 months. It took him 6 months to get in front of the judge, and the government could not explain why they'd violated him. They had two reasons. One was he was currently committing the same types of crimes that he was originally arrested for. And two, he had left the jurisdiction on many occasions without notifying them. Now, Frank has an ankle monitor on, so it's not possible for him to leave the jurisdiction. And when they said, we'd like to know who said that Frank is breaking the law or committing some kind of a fraud, who said that and where's the proof? The government ended up saying they had that his probation officer had gotten an anonymous phone call on both of those two violations. One, that he was currently engaged in breaking the law by committing criminal activities, although it was never specified. They said he's doing the same thing he was doing that originally got him thrown in prison. And they said that he had left the jurisdiction multiple times without telling them. Probation officer called the U.S. attorney. U.S. attorney said, violate him, because they want to throw him back in jail. They throw him back in jail, takes 6 months for him to get back in front of the judge. And the judge says, what are you talking about? You got a couple phone calls and you violated him? Like, what are you doing? I think he gave him 10 days to come up with the actual proof. 10 days later, they couldn't. He said, let him go. Put him back back on an ankle monitor, put him back on the street. So he got back out and he's out to this day. So that's kind of where it's at. Like, I haven't spoken to Frank. I know people that have spoken to Frank. He's supposedly doing very well, but he's also at this point very, very timid, very scared. He knows how bad the government wants to lock him up. You know, whether they're scared, whether they're concerned that he's going to eventually, you know, create another Mirabilis and work on world domination, who knows? I don't know what their thought process is. The fact that he owes roughly $200 million, that can't make him happy. But I don't know. I don't know what the crux of the issue is. I just know they desperately want to put him back in prison. And that I definitely just want to, you know, sell some books, bro. I just want to sell some books. I want to get this turned into a series. I think it would make an amazing, I don't even think it'd make an amazing movie. I think it would make an amazing series. So that's really where I'm at. I'm trying to pitch the story to producers, and I wrote a book. Book sells well. Please buy the book. And if you buy the book, please do me a favor. Don't just buy the book. Buy the book, read the book, and leave a review. It doesn't even need to be five sentences. It can be one sentence. It can be seven or eight words. It can be two sentences. A very short review. The reviews do help. I really do appreciate it. Here is the book. It's Insanity. I'm sure that Colby will play the trailer that I made. It's really just the back of the book. And I had somebody narrate it and threw in some B-roll. And then there's pictures of Frank in it too. It's a super, I did a great job. I did an amazing job. Anyway, definitely, I appreciate it. I appreciate you guys watching this whole thing. I'm sorry if I was all over the place. I'm trying to recount. I'm trying to recount all of this. I'm trying to remember all of it. I'm trying to remember everything as we go. And I was basically kind of just flipping through the book as I went to kind of revise my memory. I really appreciate you guys watching this. I appreciate you guys watching the channel, any of the videos. Do me a favor, buy the book. Consider joining my Patreon because it does help, believe it or not. And I have a lot of other books. Look in the description. All the links will be there. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Leave me a comment. Share the video. Do the right thing. See ya.
Buried by the U.S. government and ignored by the national media, this is the story they don't want you to know. When Frank Amadeo met with President George W. Bush at the White House to discuss NATO operations in Afghanistan, no one knew that he'd already embezzled nearly $200 million from the federal government, money he intended to use to bankroll his plan to take over the world. From Amadeo's global headquarters in the shadow of Florida's Disney World, with a nearly inexhaustible supply of the Internal Revenue Service's funds, Amadeo acquired multiple businesses, amassing a mega conglomerate. Driven by his delusions of world conquest, he negotiated the purchase of a squadron of American fighter jets and the controlling interest in a former Soviet ICBM factory. He began work to build the largest private militia on the planet, over 1 million Africans strong. Simultaneously, Amadeo hired an international black ops force to orchestrate a coup in the Congo while plotting to take over several small Eastern European countries. The most disturbing part of it all is, had the U.S. government not thwarted his plans, he might have just pulled it off. It's Insanity, the bizarre true story of a bipolar megalomaniac's insane plan for total world domination. Available now on Amazon and Audible.